Welcome to the Invest with Clarity podcast, where you will learn how success in investing, as in life, is the result of absolute clarity. Mark Pearson of Nepsis in Minneapolis, Minnesota, shares his passion for portfolio management and commitment to transparency and communication to allow investors to fully understand what they own and why, bringing them to clarity in their investments. And now, here are your co-hosts, Matt Halloran and Mark Pearson.
Hello and welcome to another Invest with Clarity podcast. I am your host, Matt Halloran. So some articles have recently come out, and the team at Nepsis has actually written its great blog. And we're going to dive into this today, which is the delusion of passive investing. Chuck, I'm going to turn this right over to you to kind of tee it up, and then I can't wait to hear what you and Mark are talking about today.
Well, thank you for doing that, Matt. Great to be with everyone once again here. And it was amazing. So I'm in the left coast. Certainly, Mark is right in the center of the country. And I get a text from Mark, hey, are you watching CNBC this morning? And well, of course I am. And he took a snippet of their reporting about, again, active managers underperforming once again in 2021. And then they wrote an entire piece on this, and I'm going to read it to you all here. Active investors had an awful year in 2021 as the market surged. What they consistently do wrong, meaning investors who like active management. So I think it's really neat, Matt, and of course, Mark, that we wrote this blog, and it was sent out 2 days ago, because we believe at Nepsis that certainly active management does work and is prudent to employ if done appropriately. And I believe that the industry has created a false narrative. And that's what we wrote in this blog about this delusion. And it's interesting, in this blog, we kind of teed this up, and I'll use the Oxford Dictionary if I could, because it uses a lot of big words, but here we go. So this is what delusion means: an idiosyncratic belief or impression that is firmly maintained despite being contradicted by what is generally accepted as reality or rational argument. Now, the synonyms, and I'll just end on this, I'm going to pass it back to Mark: misleading, deluding, and deceptive. So what are we here to say today is that if active management is done appropriately and is executed through a strategy and a process, it does produce the results that investors ultimately desire. And we want to also make the case today that there is no such thing as passive investing, because each one of these indexes that is defined as such actually has a human element, a major human element behind it that decides what goes into that index. So that's our thesis for today, Matt. And we're going to unravel this post-mark, and I can't wait to get started.
All right, unravel.
A couple things. First of all, if you want to see that blog, go to investwithclarity.com, and you can see that blog amongst other blog pieces. You know, if I can be selfish for a minute, guys, I'm actually, as we unpack this, we're going to talk about how the stats are not necessarily accurate, but the snippet I sent them said that, 86% of managers underperform the indexes over 10 years. Is that what it was?
That's exactly what it was.
Selfishly, I wish those were really accurate, because here I was sent you this information thinking, you know, we don't publish returns, and we do that very specifically. And the reason for that is that returns are historical, which means they've already happened. So what's happened in the past does not necessarily mean it's going to happen in the future. However, we have had tremendous performance on a relative and absolute basis. And oftentimes my marketing team and others will say, even Matt has said, why don't you guys publish your returns? And my response to that is because returns are not the most important thing. Clarity is the understanding of knowing your process, knowing what you own and why you own it, and understanding the process to which decisions are made within the portfolio. And I, frankly, selfishly, I don't want to see a bunch of assets coming in the door that, for lack of better phrase, are chasing historical returns. That's bad for the investor. It gets us more assets, but that's not the best thing for the investor. The best thing for the investor is to know the process behind how their decisions are made in their portfolio. Someone I know very close to me said that they had an interview yesterday with one of the top advisors from a top firm here in the country. And that advisor said, right now is not the time to be doing anything. And I thought, that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life.
You got it.
When you've had a shrink of price to earnings ratio, you have seen great companies go on sale. The problem is, more than likely, that advisor doesn't have the flexibility to take advantage of buying companies on sale, and more than likely is probably using mutual funds and exchange traded funds as their asset allocation strategy. So they don't have the ability to take advantage of buying great companies on sale. Sorry, I digress for a minute. The CNBC, when they were talking about this today, Chuck, I'll say this and I'll give it back to you.
Yeah.
They said that the stock picker had several problems. Problem number one, they charge too much.
Yes.
Problem number two, they're overconfident. Number three, market timing is impossible to get right consistently. And four, there's tough competition. Now, they're saying these things as it pertains to the mutual fund business. I'll be blunt. We charge 2.15% to manage money. Part of that is the advisory fee. Part of that is the money management fee. Our returns are based on those kinds of fees. I always love it when someone says they charge too much. Who makes the decision on what is charged too much? Does that mean when you buy a Mercedes, you pay too much instead of buying a Hyundai or a Chevrolet? No, you buy a Mercedes because you see the value in what you're getting. Our clients see the value in what they get in the asset management that Nepsis uses, i.e., our buy discipline, our sell discipline, our investment process. I'll give it back to you, Chuck.
You nailed it, Mark. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to even unpack that article, right, that spoke to that. You went over the charge too much, certainly excellently so. And let's talk about this. They trade too much and they exhibit overconfidence in their ability to pick winners. They don't even define what trade too much means. I'd like two things here. Talk about strategic cost averaging. That not necessarily is trading, but what it does do is it allows the confidence, right, the conviction of understanding the business, know what it's truly worth. And why wouldn't you, if you understand its true value, when it gets overvalued, trim the position or add more when it becomes undervalued? They strip right. this part out. They actually, like, they just throw this out like this is something that everyone tries to do and they do it wrong. That's incorrect. This is right. the hallmark of what we do at Nepsis. So please speak to that.
First of all, strategic cost averaging. Strategic cost averaging is the ability to strategically continue to invest in a business or divest of a business at strategic points based on buy discipline and sell discipline. So we are constantly adding to companies we own. We are constantly taking profits in companies that we own over time. That is active management. Market timing, we completely agree with. You cannot right. time the bottom of an economic cycle or a stock market correction, or frankly, the logic behind a stock. I mean, I look at a stock like Qualcomm, for full disclosure, one of our largest holdings, and stock got down to lower than basically where it was after they announced their last quarterly earnings, exactly. when the stock went to 155 and went from 155 to 193 and now went down to 143 in this correction. Does that mean it's a dead company you don't want to own anymore? Heck no, yeah. You want to buy more. And that's exactly what we did. And so the point is that the methodology or the process to which Nepsis used inherently includes the power of strategic cost averaging. The power of strategic cost averaging is inherently based upon buy discipline and sell discipline. Now, the most important aspect of what I just said is that if we follow that process, you take away the emotional component of investing. You take away, frankly, not only the overconfidence, but how about the underconfidence?
Yes.
How about seeing yourself consistently getting beat up and being wrong in the short term? And I'll tell you, it happens to every money manager, including myself. I get overconfident and I get underconfident all the time. The difference is I follow the asset allocation strategy.
Exactly.
I follow the discipline. This is why during COVID, This is why during the financial crisis, this is why during this correction, we have been extremely active and investing in the companies we want to own, taking profit. You know, we own a lot of Devon Energy. Matt asked, and Matt was anxious to hear what I've done about portfolio. Devon Energy went from literally last year, first of all, it was the number one performing stock in the S&P 500. Correct. It was not Meta. It was not Google. It was not Netflix or NVIDIA. It was Devon Energy. And while we took profit along the way, Devon Energy was up 37% year to date 2 weeks ago. Now it's pulled back a little bit. You know, it became a large piece of the portfolio. Do I think oil's going a lot higher? Yes, I do. Do I think Devon Energy is going a lot higher? Yes, I do. But the discipline states at the allocation level you own, don't be afraid to take profit. Don't be afraid to take cash off the table, redeploy cash when things are on sale. This is one of the most important aspects of asset allocation. Notice I said asset allocation, not diversification.
Mark, excellent. And I'd like to unpack the other two that they stated here if we could, as I think this is just going to raise your ire, as I like to do here.
It's superb.
So here's the one, and this one's going to parlay, I think, into our blog really well. So this was, I think, number four on their list. The mathematics are against active stock picking. So I'm going to kind of take this one here, but I want to draw this into a comment that you have made for years, that one of the greatest, I'll call it inventions, but things of all time is this market where you can go and buy companies in a liquid format, meaning liquidity, and we'll speak to that. But here's what I want to just say here, because that's what really raises my ire. So let's talk about this. If you take a look, if you aggregate what's on companies that sell in the NASDAQ composite, the New York Stock Exchange will limit to those, including ADRs, there's about 6,000 publicly traded companies. There's not one index that is non-market cap weighted, meaning weighting the index by size, that includes all 6,000. So when people talk about the market or these indexes, they quote the Dow Jones Industrial. Well, what is the Dow Jones Industrial? It's a subjectively developed price-weighted index of 30 companies. Now, yes. Think about this, 30 companies designed to replicate the universe of 6,000. Now, let me tell you how manipulative this can be. You think of a company like Apple, and you've talked about Apple, great company. I'm not going to disrespect Apple, but Apple and now Amazon, Tesla, and also Alphabet all split or will be splitting their shares so they then can become in that index. Now, just think about that, a corporate decision to drive ownership into your company so you can be put into this index, which is a subjectively, meaning that there's a committee that sits there of human beings who decides who goes into the Dow. So just kind of speak to that about how this whole process is just, it's a false narrative. And it just, again, it raises my ire. But I want you to talk about how the 6,000 publicly traded companies, think about the S&P 500 as well, right? The same thing, subjectively determined. It's only 18% of the world's financial assets. Why would you limit yourself to that?
All right. Well, this is my opinion, first of all. My opinion, first of all, is I wouldn't follow any index. And the reason why I wouldn't follow any index is because you can't follow an index if you don't even fundamentally understand how an index creates its returns. So for an example, you said the Dow Jones. The Dow is an index based on the stock price.
Right.
Price.
Yeah.
Not the value. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. I mean, how many people you've heard say, bought this 7 cent stock. I got to buy 10,000 shares of the 7 cent stock. It was only 7 cents. It was super cheap. How do you know that 7 cent stock was cheap? Maybe it should be worth a penny.
Yes.
Cheap is relative. Price is relative. Meaning the price of a stock does not necessarily indicate the value of the company. Now, the Dow Jones has been around for many decades. I think indexes were created to give people a snapshot
of
how the economy was doing, not a snapshot of how their portfolio was doing. Those are two extremely different things. We want to know how the economy is doing. Look at the Dow. It used to be just the Dow years and years ago.
Yes.
Until the S&P 500 came in. Now, the S&P 500 is market cap weighted. Now, that makes a little bit more sense than price, because price is relative. Market cap is absolute. Here's absolutely the market cap of the company, and what the stock price is not as important as what the actual market cap of the company is. But that said, do you know how the S&P 500 calculates its returns based on those market caps? We've talked historically about how the S&P 500 has done so well. And when it does super well, generally it's 5 to 10 stocks that make up 80 to 90% of the overall return of that index. And that's the same with the NASDAQ. So in other words, when you're looking at the performance of the S&P or the NASDAQ, you have to fundamentally understand in the back of your mind that more than likely 5 to 10 stocks are driving the majority of the return of that index. If you want to be smart, go look at the top 10 stocks of the index and buy those companies. Now, I'm saying that rhetorically, of course. Right. Don't go do that. Do your own due diligence and research. But let me tell you, 10 years ago, they talk about how the S&P's done over the last 10 years. Just imagine if 10 years ago, you bought Netflix, you bought Amazon, you bought Facebook, you bought Nvidia. These stocks have done phenomenal over the last 10 years. But the problem with indexes is, again, you don't know how the returns are calculated, what companies are being included in that, and how much weighting they get to that return. And frankly, more importantly, what you really want to know is, what do I even have in my portfolio that is contributing to the returns that I'm getting? Because when people say I own the S&P 500 index, they're saying I'm diversified, I own 500 companies. You may be diversified, but you're not asset allocated. And the reality is, benchmarking is an apples to oranges comparison, period. I don't care how you want to slice it. People use benchmarking. Financial advisors use benchmarking, bluntly, to justify their job.
Exactly.
Can I jump in here real quick? Because I just, Mark, you just said something that I don't know if I'm making a false equivalency here, so you can tell me if I'm wrong. But when, you know, the other financial services professionals are investing in mutual funds, they don't know what's in the mutual funds either. And the performance of the mutual fund is also probably very similar to how the markets or the indexes are related. Is that a fair statement or am I way off there?
Fair statement. Mutual funds, some of the ironically and actually, now this is a general statement, not specific. So you got to do your own research on this. But generally experience, my experience has been that when I look at the top 10 holdings of a mutual fund, of the ones that do outperform market, they generally are heavily weighted in their top 10 holdings. And this is one of the reasons why we believe in owning, you know, 25 to 35 companies in our portfolio with a conviction index that we use versus owning 200, 300, 500, or 10,000 companies. You over-diversify, you over-asset allocate, and you really are kind of stuck with what happens overall with your quote unquote market over longer periods of time. This is the same, frankly, Matt, with ETFs. And there's a growing use of ETFs / exchange traded funds. The only real difference between an ETF and a mutual fund is that mutual funds, and they're referred to as open-end mutual funds, they price their fund at the end of each day. So if you have a market correction going on, and the market's open down 2%. And we've seen a lot of this year, right? Here's a classic example of one of the things I've said many times before. If you want to be an investor, you want every stinking advantage you can get to create alpha. Mutual funds don't do it, because if the market's down 2% at the open, you can't go buy businesses that are on super cheap when the market closes up 2%. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, Chuck, didn't we have a 6% swing one day? One day, it was like 6 or 7% swing in the index. 7%.
Yes, it was the most incredible day ever from that standpoint of percentage. Unbelievable.
You want to be able to buy these businesses on sale. Mutual funds are limited in the ability to do that. And when you buy a mutual fund or when you sell a mutual fund, you get priced at the end of the day. Again, I want every advantage I can get. ETFs are a little bit different. ETFs trade on the open market. They are liquid during the day. You can buy them during the day right at the market. You can sell them right whenever you want and sell at the market when you want to. So there are some advantages to ETFs and mutual funds, but the big disadvantage to both is you don't know what you own. You don't know why you own it. You don't know what the weightings are of the companies you own. And by the way, most people own 5, 6, 7, 10, 15 ETFs and mutual funds in their portfolio, and then they get a management fee slapped on top of it. And the simple question I want to ask is, what is being managed? What is being managed in that? And this is one of the dilemmas and the issues facing the financial advisory business right now, is this ability to tell a client, justify what they do for managing their money for them. As investors become more and more intellectual, they become smarter about investing. And COVID was the greatest example of this. We talked about this before, Matt. When the market was crashing 30% in a month, a lot of clients, investors went to their advisors and said, why didn't we take advantage of this when this was happening? It was an exaggerated crash. It went quick. And what it taught investors was, wow, I really need to have some flexibility here in my portfolio. And here at Nepsis, we were literally sitting here buying stuff while it was crashing. We pray for these corrections and crashes. We want to see these things happen. We just went back and bought Square lower than when we, 40 to 50% lower than what we sold it a year and a half ago at a much higher price. We got to buy it back. That's what corrections provide us. That's the flexibility and transparency of knowing what you own and why you own it.
Closing statements, gentlemen. Chuck.
Yeah, I have one more for Mark here. So we've walked through all six of these, right? The delusion of passive investing. There is no such thing, right? You got 6,000 companies to buy open on the market. The indexes that are developed are false narratives. I want to speak to this one, Mark, because I want you to end on this, my friend. The last one they said is the hot hands manager doesn't last. Now, you and I have chronicled this for years. You go back to 1965 when Berkshire Hathaway, right, started buying companies and really became an investment vehicle. Warren Buffett has three good years of performance and then gets slaughtered. Every third year, he underperforms the so-called benchmark, but he's doubled that over time as he has stuck to his process. And I want you to just speak to that about the conviction, the consistency, because one of the people that are now the whooping people of this history is Cathie Wood, right? And she has a very different discipline than we do, but she's sticking to it and she's being slaughtered in the press for that. I want you to talk about how this hot hands manager does last over time, if in fact they stick to their discipline. And let's end on that, if that's okay.
Okay, you said a lot of stuff there.
Yep.
Listen, in the years I've been managing money, I can think of 2 years where I underperformed quote unquote markets, 17 and 18. It was because of one stock. Just one. I knew what I owned. I knew why I owned it. We stuck to that stock. We continue to own that stock. And over the next 3 years after that, we doubled the performance of the indexes, meaning those 2 years were completely irrelevant. High-performing managers do underperform on an annual basis occasionally. And the reason for that is spelled out in our investment policy statement, which says we are willing to give up short-term performance for long-term gain. We are willing to give up and have short-term underperformance, knowing that the discipline and the process that we use longer term will pay off. And that's what it's done for us. Now, of course, there's no guarantees. You got to say that. But historically, that's been the case. In the Cathie Wood discipline, she runs an ETF, and she's very vocal about what the discipline is of that ETF. And yeah, she got hammered. And that's because there is a shift in the valuation of how people value businesses. I never criticize any money manager. I never give yes or no to anything. Whatever her discipline is, she's going to stick to it. Maybe it'll work. Maybe it won't. I don't know. But I do know this. At Nepsis, we have a very specific discipline. We have a very specific asset allocation strategy. And we have a very specific buy and sell discipline. And that has paid off handsomely for us. And we're going to continue to do it.
All right. With that, everybody, here's another show in the can. Listen, here's the deal. You can't listen to what everybody else is saying and expect a different result. You have to actually have a different philosophy and outlook. Hearing other financial services professionals repeatedly say, we're not going to do anything because we rebalance on the quarter. We rebalance annually, right? When you can buy something on sale 30%, 40%, and you don't take advantage of this, and if your advisor is specifically saying, we don't own individual equities because it's too risky, you really need to have a good think about it. Because if you look at the most successful investors of our time, it's all about individual equities.
Absolutely.
Got it.
If you have not subscribed to the podcast, make sure you click that subscribe now button below. And of course, somebody who needs to hear this, so click that share button. That would be fantastic. And also, if you don't mind, give us a quick rating on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you're listening to the show. That helps us get found more in search engines so we can help more people invest with clarity. For Mark and Chuck, this is Matt Halloran. We'll see you on the other side of the mic very soon.
The content discussed is for informational purposes only. It is not a solicitation or recommendation for any securities that may be mentioned herein. Advisory services offered through Nepsis, Inc., an SEC-registered investment advisor.